So I'm presenting on behalf of my colleagues in GISP, the Gonococcal Isolate Surveillance Project, and I'll be talking about recent trends in cephalosporin antimicrobial susceptibilities in the U.S. So, you know, we've heard this many times during this conference. We know that rapid detection and prompt and effective therapy is a cornerstone of gonorrhea control in the U.S., but gonococcal antimicrobial resistance threatens control by undermining treatment effectiveness. And as we know, this bug has developed resistance to each of the antimicrobials that's been used for therapy. And since 2007, since the fluoroquinolones were thrown by the wayside as the bug developed resistance, the cephalosporins have been the foundation of the only recommended treatment regimen. But yet, cephalosporin resistance is an emerging public health threat. And as background, these are data you're probably familiar with from GISP. This shows the proportion of urethral Neisseria gonorrhoeae isolates with elevated cefixime MICs, those with MICs greater than or equal to 0.025, from 2006 to 2011. And we see this really raised alarm in the U.S. because the percentage really increased rather dramatically between 2006 and 2010. In response to global trends about cephalosporin resistance and trends in the U.S., CDC has changed recommended treatment for gonorrhea several times the past few years. So as you remember, when fluoroquinolone resistance emerged in 2007, ceftriaxone and cefixime were the only remaining recommended treatment regimens. By 2010, dual therapy with a cephalosporin backbone plus a second drug were recommended. Largely in part due to the trends we were seeing in GISP, by 2012, the only recommended first-line treatment regimen was ceftriaxone, 250 milligrams IM, plus a gram of azithromycin or doxycycline. This also mirrors similar treatment changes that were done in other regions and other countries around the world. So the objective of this analysis was to describe recent gonococcal susceptibility trends in the U.S., particularly after the treatment recommendations were issued. So we used data from 2009 through 2013 from the Gonococcal Isolate Surveillance Project, or GISP, which you're probably familiar with, but is a U.S.-based sentinel surveillance system that's supported by CDC. 25 to 30 U.S. cities participate. And it samples, each of the clinical sites sample up to the first 25 urethral isolates from men who have gonococcal urethritis each month per city. And this surveillance occurs throughout the year. In addition, limited demographic and clinical data are collected. And the isolates are sent to one of five regional laboratories, and antimicrobial susceptibility is performed using agar dilution on a panel of antimicrobials. These are the GISP sites as of 2013, when the data used for this analysis was. You see the dots, the yellow dots are the clinical sites, largely public health clinics, and the sites in boxes are the regional laboratories. So we calculated the proportion of isolates with elevated MICs and 95% confidence intervals. We considered cefixime MICs of greater than 0.25, more elevated than ceftriaxone MICs greater than 0.125. These are the characteristics of the men. During this time period, there were 28,000 men from whom isolates were collected. The median age was 26. And as similar to reported cases in the U.S., about approximately 66% of the men were black or African American. 30.5% were men who have sex with men. And as you may have seen from the map, just relatively oversampled from the West compared to where most of the gonorrhea is in the U.S. So in the GISP sample, about 36% of isolates from the West, 23% from the Midwest, and then Northeast and South were combined. So we saw the previous slide in the background where the proportion with elevated MICs had increased starting in 2006. What we see since then is a plateauing in 2011 and then a significant decrease starting in 2012 and continuing into 2013. Now, these are preliminary data, but I think these will reflect our final data as well. Also, I'll show the data stratified by region and sex of sex partner. The MICs increased rather sharply initially in the West, and it's a pattern that we saw epidemiologically with the fluoroquinolones and also with penicillin resistance. But also, you see the bars in orange are isolates from the West, and you see the percentage in this region has also fallen rather dramatically. We see an increase in the Midwest here in the red bars, but that also has fallen by 2013. These are the same data stratified by gender of sex partner, with MSM, or men who have sex with men, shown in light blue, and MSW, men who have sex with women, shown in orange. And as we've seen previously and with other drugs, the prevalence of elevated MICs or resistance increased rather sharply among men who have sex with men, but this percentage has also fallen rather dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years. Now moving on to ceftriaxone, we see a similar pattern. These are the percentage of isolates with elevated ceftriaxone MICs. After peaking in 2011, the percentage decreased to 0.03%. Now you see, even though the pattern is overall the same, you see the percentage of isolates over here is quite much lower than for cefixime. And we see a similar pattern by region and gender of sex partner as well, whereas although the percentages are smaller, the proportion with elevated MICs was highest in the West, and that's come down, again, in the orange bars, and also in the Midwest, you see in red. And similarly, with gender of sex partner, among MSM, the percentage had increased among those with elevated MICs, and that also has declined. So as a last slide, diverting slightly from the objective, but I wanted to, because we're in the era of dual therapy, I wanted to show the proportion of GISP isolates with tetracycline resistance or elevated azithromycin MICs, so considered two or greater. And we see a persistence of a high prevalence of tetracycline resistance, which you would also expect to confer doxycycline resistance, but also a continued low level of isolates that have elevated azithromycin MICs to 0.06% in 2013. Limitations of this analysis are GISP approximately 4% of the number of reported male gonococcal cases in the U.S. It's an STD clinic population, so we can't say it's entirely representative of the entire universe of gonorrhea in the U.S. And because resistance has tended to emerge from the West and gone eastward in the U.S., by design, just relatively oversamples the Western region. But it has GISP has shown to provide reliable trends over time that do reflect trends in other populations in the U.S. But because of this possible bias in the sampling, this could affect a point prevalence over time, or a point prevalence in one specific time, but you wouldn't expect it to affect the trends. And lastly, I've shown the data as a binary MIC category, so elevated MICs or not. And this could mask some MIC creep that might be occurring at lower MICs as well. But actually, we're not really seeing that. So in conclusion, after increasing from 2006 to 2011, the prevalence of isolates with elevated cefixime MICs has decreased. And this is not unique to the United States. You may have seen in other presentations during the session, even in the last session, we saw similar data from Canada. Our colleagues in the United Kingdom have an excellent poster that have shown similar patterns. These trends do appear to be temporarily associated with changes in treatment recommendations, so going to higher doses of ceftriaxone and institutionalizing a second drug. But it is unclear if these changes are causal, if those changes are directly translating into these trends we're seeing, and possibly there might be other things going on, such as the mutations that are conferring elevated MICs might cause the bug to have problems, and there might be a fitness cost, so it might not be able to grow because of having to get mutations that cause it other problems. So, you know, and while encouraging, I think that we're still in a similar position. So, you know, perhaps at this stage we have the gonococcus a little bit on its back heel, but we do know this is a bug that's highly mutable. We know that it can develop resistance very rapidly, and at this time we still only have one recommended treatment. So it's definitely not a time to be complacent. And, you know, while we don't know exactly what's causing these trends, there is the possibility that the more aggressive treatment that we're using is contributing. So we certainly want to continue treating gonorrhea with, at least in the United States, with CDC-recommended treatment of ceftriaxone and azithromycin 1 gram, and certainly in other countries following the treatment recommendations. that have been issued. And additionally, it's critically important to continue surveillance of Neisseria gonorrhea resistance and in the long term, also short and long term, continue our search for new drugs, new preventive strategies, including the elusive goal of a vaccine. So I'd like to thank all of those who are involved with GIST, both the at CDC, the regional laboratories, and our invaluable clinical partners during this time period. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Can I come to the microphone? Yeah, because I think this... Okay, I'll repeat it.
Ask you to comment on the use of expedited perfect therapy for gonorrhea. Do you still support it?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly if someone... For people that you can bring into the clinic and get treated with ceftriaxone and azithromycin, that's going to be the best. You know, certainly we know programs struggle with trying to get people in, certainly partners, and EPT has been shown to be effective for gonorrhea. So that's an important weapon in our arsenal. So certainly, you know, make every effort to bring partners in, test them, treat them, but if you can't, you know, I think EPT certainly is, you know, still remains a valuable tool. And at this time, you know, probably the best of the oral options, I would think cefixime and azithromycin combination would be the best option for EPT.
Mark Ternak, Boston. I was curious, over your period of time, if you have a feel for the diversity of the clones you have within your sample. You speak of, you know, how you're sampling across the country, but is there a sort of convergence of the number of sort of clones that you're testing, or is that, do you have any view into that, I guess is the question.
We'll hopefully in the future have more. What I can tell you, and from the work we've done with our colleagues at Harvard and Dr. Jonathan Grad, through genome sequencing, it looked like up through 2009 and 10, those isolates that had elevated MICs tended to fall into two lineages. One of them tended to be, resistant to many of the other antimicrobials, such as penicillin, tetracycline, and cipro. And there was also a second lineage that seemed to, and that seemed to have spread throughout the country, and there was a second lineage that seemed to be susceptible to many other antibiotics. Now, we're in the process of looking at, you know, from 2010 onward, looking at those through sequencing and trying to find out what's going on. You know, did one of them drop off? At least looking at the phenotypes from the last few years, it does look like those isolates with elevated MICs tend to be much more likely now to be resistant to penicillin, tetracycline, and cipro. So it's probable that out of those two lineages, those two different clones, you know, one of them, the one that was more susceptible, dropped off for whatever reason, you know, and now we're seeing the one that's pan-susceptible, or pan, you know, resistant to everything else. So I think more work needs to be done on that.